welcome to Make Your Shit, a podcast about empowering creatives like yourself to overcome obstacles, the real ones and the ones you imagined, to push through moments of doubt and indecision, to find the joy in the work that you want to do, and ultimately, to give yourself permission to make the shit that you want to make. I'm your host, Kyle F. Andrews. I'm a screenwriter, actor, producer, and creative advocate. I've spent the better part of the last decade helping artists, industry pros, and people who didn't necessarily see themselves as creatives take strides to break into the business, hone their skills, and most importantly, find their voice in an industry that just doesn't want to listen. My guest this week is author, producer, and fellow podcaster Jessica Hobbs, whose new book of short stories, entitled The Witch and Other Tales of the American Gothic, is currently being released as a fully cast and narrated audio drama. You'll find the link to her show in the show notes. Jessica and I discuss her experience transitioning from filmmaking into book and podcast writing, the secret weapon of podcast production, how creativity works as a response to the world around you, and why horror is such a great vehicle for saying exactly what you want. If you'd like to support the show, click that follow button, share us with your friends, and give us a shout out on Instagram and Twitter at MYS Podcast. If you'd like to follow me, I'm on Instagram at Kyle F. Andrews. Jessica Hobbs is a writer with a BA in Film Studies from the University of Colorado Boulder, a background in theater, opera, vaudeville, television production, and film festivals, and a passion for all things strange and unusual. If she's not writing, Jessica's likely to be on a movie set, traveling around the world, practicing witchcraft, or blasting rock and roll records in her living room. She lives in the magical Laurel Canyon neighborhood in Los Angeles with her composer husband Robinson and their cat Freya. Jessica's book and podcast, The Witch and Other Tales of the American Gothic, is a collection of strange occurrences in 19th century America, written in the literary tradition of Gothic horror. These seven stories provide a reflection of the country's growing pains during a time of transition and an exploration of the secrets that lurk in the shadows of the world we think we know. It's really nice to have an opportunity to talk to a fellow podcaster. You know, if you're listening to this, you may already have a routine with your podcasts. You have some talk shows you listen to. Maybe you have some audio dramas you like to listen to. I listen to a ton of audio dramas. I say in the interview about 500. Maybe it's not 500, but it's probably close. I mean, I've listened to a lot of them. And I got a chance to listen to Jessica's podcast, The Witch and Other Tales of the American Gothic, and it's awesome. It's so cool because, you know, there are different kinds of podcasts out there. However many resources you have at your disposal kind of says what you can do in the course of a podcast production. But at the same time, you don't need a lot of resources to get it done. I talk about making your shit. I mean, obviously, the show's called Make Your Shit. But making your shit, a lot of the barriers that people put in their way to begin with, well, I don't have the resources I need to make what I want to make. But if you have a microphone and a computer and the ability to write and think, then you are already well on your way to being able to craft a story that other people can take in and appreciate and maybe share with their friends and, I don't know, grow a following. And that's kind of what I'm hoping Jessica can get out of that. There are three episodes of the show up right now, which are represent three different stories from her book. They are The Witch, The Debutante, and The Acrobat. Already, you should be interested because those are awesome titles. She's got a full cast of really great actors. The music from her composer husband is just like, hey, if you could get good music, you are well on your way to having a really great podcast. So please take a listen to our interview here and then go check out Jessica's show. Once again, this is my interview with Jessica Hobbs. Jessica, thank you for coming on the show. I'm really happy to have you on today.
I'm glad to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about your journey as an author and a writer, how you got into writing in the first place?
Yeah, well, I sort of always just toyed with writing, but I think most people, for whatever reason, don't lean into defining themselves that way as a writer for a long time. Just writing is just so incredibly vulnerable, especially in something, if you're writing a book or stories or something narrative, because there's so much less collaboration. So when you write a movie, the finished product is also the vision of the director. It's also the vision of the DP, of the actors, of course. So much of your work is in their hands. But if you decide to write a book, then that's all you. And you'll have help, sure, editors and people who will help you craft the story, but it is purely your vision and purely your voice. And so I think it's difficult for a lot of people to really own that because it's such a vulnerable thing. So it took a while for me as well. And for years, I've worked in the film industry for a long time. I went to film school and worked for big major festivals, some production companies. I did reality TV. I did narrative. I did indie films. Even when I was working full time, I would be producing or script supervising, being on set for indie films, and also just kind of writing here and there. And the ball started to roll when I was actually pitching myself to be a producer on an indie film with this director. This was a while ago now, maybe about 8 years ago. And she asked me to do a rewrite on the script. And I was so excited. I wasn't expecting that question, but I was like, I would love to do a rewrite on your script. So I did. And I just really got the bug. And then I found other collaborators, other directors who wanted, you know, somebody to come in and help them craft their vision. And it wasn't until 2020, though, until the pandemic hit, that the thing about writing in Hollywood, as I'm sure you know, is that so much of what you write for other people or with other people just doesn't really see the light of day. I mean, 99.9% of all this work gets shelved and it's out there. And, you know, it, when production companies decide to make it and directors decide to run with it, that will be great. But in the meantime, I just thought I need a project that I have more control over. That's also going to come with the more vulnerability, of course. And so I began writing a book.
The fact that you led in with indie film to start is great, because I think a lot of people listening to the show will be working in the indie film side of things, working on screenplays, doing their 15th, 16th, 17th spec script, trying to figure out where to go from there. I think the exciting part is not only did you transition a bit and start writing a book, but it seems as though you have a good book that is getting out there. What's been your experience transitioning into making a book? And I should say, we have a book to talk about today, The Witch and Other Tales of the American Gothic, which I'm super excited about. So what was the process like for you?
Well, it really just started with one story. It's a collection of short stories. And in 2020, two things kind of happened because the pandemic hit. And once we settled into the notion that this was not going to go away anytime soon, we all, of course, were feeling extremely isolated and also had time on our hands that we were not spending commuting or really living so much of our lives. I was still working, thankfully, my job at the time transitioned just fine to working remotely, but I was so tired of screens and so tired of being on Zoom that at night I would just lay down and listen to audiobooks, and I had time to go back and read books that I had never actually gotten to, which a person, a horror fan like myself, it was a little surprising that I'd never read The Legend of Sleepy Hollow or The Scarlet Letter. And so those were the vibes that were just kind of in my mind. At the same time that we were thinking about this isolation, I lean a little more extrovert on the scale. I was not pleased with the state of things, as so many of us were not. And I just sort of started thinking about back in the day, back in the time that so many of these books were set that I was reading, what real isolation was like. I mean, if you were apart from your community with no Zoom and no internet and no phone and no, like, absolutely no way to reach out to other people, and totally having to learn self-reliance, especially in a place where there's harsh winter and that kind of thing, what would that be like? And so I thought, well, how would one end up sort of that isolated? Well, at that time, if you're a woman, being accused of witchcraft, pretty easy way to be exiled from your community. And so it really sort of started with that character of like, well, if that happened to somebody, what would that be like?
I got to say, there is something to key in on there is kind of the vulnerability in isolation sense. Do you feel that you found a deeper connection into writing this than you might have if you say you were trying to make a film of it?
Oh, that's a good question. I think so, because as much as I love the visual aspect of film and writing a script and finding that beautiful balance between expressing what needs to be expressed for the character's state of mind, but not telling your actors or your directors how to do their jobs. In a book, you can, or a short story, you can really just get in their head and you can really just talk about every thought or feeling they have in as much detail as you want. And for her, it started really with actually resentment, not even fear or anything like that. But one of the first parts of the story that I started sort of scribbled down was how much she hated the people who had done this So there's a lot of power in that, and that's a much more difficult thing to show on a script.
In that sense, you know, you have so few words to use in a screenplay and so many at your disposal to use in a book. Did you find the writing process of writing this book any different, any more challenging in a way than writing a script? Or was it like, did it just come out like stream of consciousness for you?
At first, it was a little more challenging because I was not used to, I mean, I couldn't tell you the last time I wrote a short story. I mean, probably in high school.
Same.
I had forgotten how much longer it takes to write a page. Because the script is just so much more succinct. And obviously the format is just so incredibly different that the first few pages I wrote out, I was just like, man, I can't believe I've been talking this much and I only have 2 pages of story.
Yeah, the white space doesn't save you as well when you've got to hit every single line with content.
Exactly. So at first that did throw me a little bit because I was so not used to the format anymore. But after I wrote the first one, the rest of the stories actually started to flow quite nicely.
And did you learn anything about yourself as a writer by doing it this way? Were there discoveries that you made in the process that you wouldn't have otherwise made?
I wouldn't say I discovered anything new, but I did really learn to lean into certain things about my process and about my just personality that I don't think I had leaned into enough recently. And a big one there is that because these were all historical fiction, I really, really, really enjoyed the research. And I leaned into my extrovert self some more, you know, and especially once we were sort of coming out of the pandemic and I had a little more flexibility to meet with people. You know, one day I would be learning about, I would be trying to figure out the exact process that lumberjacks in the 1860s were using to take down a 40-foot tree. And then the next day I'd be on the phone with a guy in Alabama who's explaining to me the history of debutante balls. And then the next day I'm on the phone with, you know, practicing witches of different, you know, forms of the craft to talk about that same story that one sets place takes place in New Orleans. And so just the learning of it and the, hey, who can I reach out to ask about this was really, really fun.
You hear the motto, write what you know. And I think a lot of people take that a bit too literally. Like you can only write about what you have deep experience in, but really you can only write about what you have deeply researched. So the research process that it sounds like you went through really led to what I believe in my experience of your work, a really authentic approach to the writing, which I always appreciate authenticity.
I'm so glad that comes across. That was very important to me.
It really does. And of course, I need to be clear with the listeners here. I have not, unfortunately, had a chance to read it yet. I got to experience it in a different way because you made it, you wrote it in the personal way, and then you took it and you made it another collaborative piece by turning it into a podcast. That's so cool. Why a podcast? Why did you make this a podcast?
It was such a great idea. It was actually my husband's idea. I hadn't thought about it, but he's a composer. And so he said, we should record these as narrative audio dramas so that I can write a score for each one. And I just thought that was such a wonderful idea. And so because I work in the film industry and I have so many contacts, I fortunately had a lot of actor friends, or at least actor friends who could find me other actors who would be right for a certain role. So I hired them to do the voices of the characters. And I, of course, read the narration. My husband did all the audio polishes. And of course, he has at his disposal a lot of audio engineers who were a big help too, and then wrote this beautiful music. And so it really came alive in a totally different way that was really, really fun. Still is really fun. We're still working on getting the last few ready.
Because you've got 2 episodes up right now, which are 2 different stories.
3, actually.
Is there a third?
3 this morning.
Oh, look at that. Well, great. Perfect timing on that. And there will be a link in the show notes to your podcast so that people can find it if they'd like. I am a podcast nerd. I have listened to probably 500 podcasts. I mean, that was my coping mechanism through getting the pandemic. I've listened to all of them. The good ones, the not so good ones, the ones that are good stories, probably could have used a bit more time on the production side. You know, a few resources voices can go a long way in this process. One of the things I was excited about in listening to yours, I expected it to be narration style, where you or another person was just reading the story to me. That is often the format in podcasts, and it's very enjoyable that way. But you went the extra step to not only narrate the piece, but also bring in actors. As you said, you had actor friends you could bring in, but was that always how you were going to do that? Or did some of this stuff happen as it went along?
That was always the plan. As soon as my husband suggested that, and I didn't even have to think about it, I just immediately said, we're absolutely doing that. I thought that right away. I wanted to do that. I really enjoyed the read myself. I really enjoyed doing the narration, and I'm glad that it worked out as well as it did. But I always wanted actual actors and voices other than my own, because it just brought so much more personality.
Did you adjust it in any sense for the actual read itself? Was it turned into like a short film kind of script, or was it everybody reading from the book?
A little of both, really. I didn't want to weigh them down too much because I just wanted to be very respectful of their time and their process. And so I went through each story and I kind of just cut out the scenes that they needed to be reading in, because again, so much of it was narration of just telling what's in their head and what's going on with the characters. And I just went and I took all the scenes that they needed and I wrote out extra context, like, okay, this is what happens next, and then to help them transition from one scene to the next. So it felt like a little bit of a good balance between the two. It was basically sides. I basically made them sides just in book form.
And what was the recording process like? Did you just have people on Zoom? Did you get a studio? What was that like?
Mostly, well, all of these actors have their own recording equipment at this point, thanks to COVID. And so much of their work has gone remote, like so many of us. So most of them were able to actually just record in their own homes and send me the files. And then my audio engineer husband did such a wonderful job of adjusting all the levels and, you know, making it sound really polished and really professional. A couple of my closer friends did come over to our place and use our mics in our studio, which was kind of nice because then I just got to have them here and we had lunch and just made it more fun.
I actually, for anybody who's going to make a podcast, I think an actual key production aspect of it is, if you're recording actors, we need to hear them like they're there, not hear them like they're speaking to us over equipment. So Zoom can be difficult unless they have their own recording equipment and you're doing it in an individual sense. Jessica, that's the kind of sense I got from you, and it felt like a full read. Is that, are you developing your own process for this as you go forward now that you've got more episodes coming in? Are you like ready to roll with it?
Yeah, I feel really great about it. And the nice thing too is, again, these actors were just so professional. I gave them so little direction. I told them what I wanted, and I told them, you know, I would send them examples, particularly because the historical aspect was very important. So I would send them examples from other films films or TV shows, just clips of like, okay, this is the speech pattern that I'm looking at, or, you know, this character is young man of means who's speaking to a woman, which means he's going to be extremely polite and cautious, you know. But other than that, I just said, I totally trust you. And they did a wonderful job, and they know their own equipment very well. And so I was really able to take it and edit it without any problems.
Well, they were very good actors, but they weren't the only good actors in this. Your performance in this, both as a narrator and as the lead character, is really remarkable. How did you bring your performance experience into the podcast?
You know, I wasn't sure what to expect of myself. Like, the very unglamorous answer to that is that the narration took a long time, especially for that first story. It's the longest story, and I didn't have the budget to pay anyone else to do it. So I did it myself. And that's the unglamorous answer. But, you know, I don't have a whole lot of performance background. I've always been sort of behind the scenes, and I've never really been a singer, but I just felt comfortable enough because I've been around it enough that I could kind of just get into the zone. And that's really all it was. I just needed a quiet, comfortable space to really just focus on the story and nothing but the story. And it worked out.
You know, I'll tell you, unglamorous answers are the kind that we want on this show, especially since, you know, the word glamour has its roots in magic. And I always want to make sure people know that there's no magic here. This is a long, hard process yeah. of getting stuff done that the end might feel quite magical when you get there.
Totally.
Do you plan on making, after The Witch and Other Tales of the American Gothic is through, at least in its first, do you plan on making more podcasts? Have you been bitten by the podcast bug? blog?
I certainly would like to. I don't know when exactly that opportunity will present itself again. I have already started noodling with my outline for my next book, which is actually going to be a full length book. It will not be a short story collection. So I would 100% read that and do an audiobook version of it. Whether or not I cast other actors is very much TBD. But yeah, in terms of podcast, I would absolutely love to. I don't have anything queued up yet.
Well, I would encourage something for you there, because only because not only are you a gifted writer, but you do have what I think is the secret weapon, the access to the composer. You have a living composer that can make anything. The music in the series is just remarkable. I think that often we as screenwriters can think of the music as an afterthought, almost like that's not where we are. Maybe I'll put in a needle drop for a song I want on the soundtrack, but I'm not going to be thinking about what the musical style is. That's not the case in a podcast. The music is so integral to how I'm feeling about the story. Can you talk a little bit about the collaborative process between writing and recording the work and the amazing musical work that your husband did?
Yeah, you know what? It was so much fun. And surprisingly, my husband and I have been together for, it is now pushing 17 years.
Congrats.
And we've never collaborated before now. And I'm not really sure why. It just hasn't come up where, because we're in different parts of the filmmaking process, right? I'm at the very, very beginning with crafting the basic story and script, and he's at the very, very end with adding the music. And so it just never really seemed to overlap until now. And it was a really, really fun experience. We're both musical people. So we actually met in a band. That was how we met. His bass player moved away. And we had a mutual friend who suggested me, because I did have a bass guitar at one point, and I did play. And
so cool.
It was not something that I kept up with as much as I maybe should have. So, you know, you go to college and your priorities change. But it, at the time, I did have it. I did play in a couple other bands in our high school. And so that was how we met. And so, of course, when I started writing the stories, one of the very first things I did was just load up playlists of music. And that was how I got into the vibe. I know a lot of writers do that, like, and directors too. It really helps you focus in on the emotions that you want to convey. So it was actually a very easy transition to sit and have those conversations with him when the stories were recorded. And I would even put in notes like, for this section, refer to this piece of music, and for this section, this piece of music. And it clearly, because this is what he does for a living, that was something he understood very well.
And it comes across really nice. Audio drama, which itself is not a, it's not a short piece. It's a nice 40 something minute long script that I love to usually just set stuff on and let it play and vibe when I hear it. But this was so personal and intimate, bring me in. I'm not going to spoil it, but it becomes a very powerful story of a person scorned. Can you talk a little bit about the roots of your own artistry and how that plays into the horror genre, taking over the scarier parts of ourselves to kind of inform our audience of really deep personal human drama? Can you speak a little bit to how you came about using horror to do that for yourself?
I'm not really sure, honestly. I mean, I've always liked horror, and you know, and I don't know why. When I was a kid, I liked horror, and I asked my mom once, as an adult, I asked her, like, why were you okay renting Child's Play for your 12-year-old? And she actually said, I wasn't, but it made you so happy, and you would like have your friends over and do sleepovers and watch Friday the 13th or whatever it was, like, you know, just people getting brutally murdered. And it just made you so happy that I wasn't going to rain on that parade. And I was like, that's a really good answer.
That's maybe the best answer I've ever heard.
Yeah. And so, and the thing is that with slasher movies, like, it's so cheesy. And I think that's maybe why even my childhood self kind of wasn't scared of it, because it almost felt more playful than anything else. It was very ridiculous, over the top effects, especially those, you know, 80s movies. And so I think when I started getting really into film, which still was also at a young age, I do remember I told my parents by the time I think it was about 12 that I wanted to go to film school. That was like, I easily just, that interest went into things like Alfred Hitchcock and the more sophisticated, suspenseful kind of horror, and reading Stephen King and that sort of thing, and Anne Rice. And I think just an appreciation for that kind of storytelling from a young age is just like, how much you can do with people when you play with their fear, really. Like, it's so effective. It's just very powerful storytelling, and it just kind of grabbed me and never let go.
Those 80s horror slasher films probably created a whole generation of auteurs, the way we all want to now. We want to twist the element of who is this slasher? What are they going through in their own personal life? How do you feel about the landscape of horror today? Is it as exciting as you expected when you first started getting into it?
I think it is. And for a minute there, I really lost faith in a lot of horror in the 2000s because it got so incredibly violent for no real good reason. You know, the like the Saw and the Hostel and those kinds of movies kind of lost me because they were just gory and violent, but without that playfulness. And I wasn't interested in that, and I was a little disappointed. And I feel like that kind of stuck that way for a long time there. I mean, those movies had so many sequels, and but then they really started getting better. And this is an excellent circle back into indie film. You know, around the time I started working for Sundance, which was in 2014, that's when some movies started coming out of that indie film scene, like A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night and The Babadook and It Follows. And I actually think that foreign films were ahead of that curve. I think that some really, really wonderful horror movies came out a few years prior to that, like maybe Let the Right One In started building an American fan base. And then filmmakers kind of took that and ran with it. And it's just blossomed into this really wonderful resurgence, and horror movies have gotten so complex and so weird and so interesting now. I just love it.
Yeah, I've always felt horror films in particular really mirror the social zeitgeist of the moment. You know, 80s slasher films, people not taking things seriously, winning the Cold War and everything, versus the fear and really questioning what the American fabric was in the wake of the War on Terror and all of the choices the country was making, bled itself into the films that we ended up having to get shoved down our throats. Now everybody is having a response to that. Is The Witch and other tales of the American Gothic a response to anything in particular?
I think a big part of it was a response to the pandemic, particularly that first story, The Witch, because it is so much about isolation. I knew pretty early on that if I wanted to continue the stories, I really wanted that same thread to connect all of them. Even though they're all different, they all take place in a different city throughout the country and across the 19th century. Because I think that was just a really fascinating time of change, really. I mean, the 20th century, of course, that we know was insanely, I mean, it changed insanely fast from one decade to the next, but really the 19th century did too. And I really liked the thought of that, and I really liked the exploration of what how certain characters were experiencing isolation and how other characters were experiencing being a part of a society. You know, and the second story is all about social pressure in an aristocratic environment. And then, you know, we've also got one about lumberjacks in the Pacific Northwest, which was also incredibly remote, but focused on, I mean, the reason that this industry had exploded at the time was that they were building so much in California. And so you were building these huge cities and this enormous booming industry and all of this money. The California Gold Rush, like they needed more and more and more lumber from up north to build for all the people who were flocking there. And yet you're doing this all for other people, and you yourself are living in a tiny little cabin in the woods. So yeah, I think that was, I think it absolutely came out of the pandemic.
I'm very, very excited to read that story, by the way. That sounds like one I want to get deeply involved in, especially my sister lived in the Pacific Northwest for a while, and there is a sense of just gorgeous isolation if you are outside of the city of Portland or Seattle. So
We're
I
just isolation is right. And I can't wait for you to hear the music in that one too.
See, this is why podcasts. This is why podcasts, because you can say something like the music is key here, and it can be a central theme of the project. I want to touch on this idea of vulnerability a little bit more, not in the actual concept itself, but more in kind of how you get through the concept. Rewriting, a lot of people don't enjoy the rewrite process. I personally find the second or third draft to be the best part of the whole thing. What's your relationship like with the rewrite process?
Pretty good. I think the biggest struggle, and this is pretty specific to this project, the biggest struggle for me on these stories was if I found out that I'd gotten something wrong historically, I got very nervous. Like, what else do I not know? You don't know what you don't know. And so if I had gone into something assuming that something was structured a certain way and then finding out it wasn't, I did worry a little bit about like, okay, well, how much more research do I need to do and how much deeper do I need to dig? And so that gave me a little bit of anxiety, but it was more of a relief that I caught it, you know, and I would, and I just changed it. I just changed what I needed to. I mean, this is a very tiny example, so it's not, this was not a make or break for the story, but like, for example, I had referenced Canada a couple of times because one of my stories takes place in Washington, another in Maine, quite close to the border. And I didn't know that Canada wasn't Canada. It was a British territory. And I referenced it as Canada. And actually, that was my mother who pointed that out to me. And I was like, oh, thank God you told me that. It never would have even crossed my mind.
When you have issues on days, do you have any trouble motivating creativity? How do you break out of a rut that you might find yourself into, especially writing in the long form of prose writing in a novel?
I don't. I just settle right into the rut because, at least for me, I can't speak for other creatives, but if you fall in the rut, it's going to be stubborn. It doesn't want you to climb out. So I had to learn, and my poor husband had to do a lot of teaching me to just set it down. And like, it's not the end of the world if you don't write today. Like, it's going to be okay. Do other things in your life. Go to the gym. Go for a walk. Like, you don't have to fight this so hard. And he's totally right. And so I just don't. And the thing about creativity though is that it really kicks your ass a lot of the time. And it's there is kind of the stereotype of the suffering artist for a reason. I don't support that stereotype, but it can really mess with our minds. And so, you know, to me it was like, all right, well, just let yourself feel it, let yourself have a down day, and it's going to come back though. Like, the muse is going to come bite you again tomorrow. It just is, because it doesn't want you to go away. It wants your attention. It'll come back.
I think that's an important thing for a lot of creatives to hear, that sometimes you can just let it sit today. I will say though, the struggling, starving artist, it would be nice to be able to remove that stereotype if only the studios weren't actively trying to make us broke by Christmas, you know?
I know. So it's a good double whammy for creatives, is that for one thing, just the creativity alone drives you crazy because you get stuck on things and there's no roadmap to get out of it. And that alone is hard enough to push through. And then when you add on the layer of, you know, intense corporate greed and capitalism on top of it, where your creativity is linked to your livelihood, that's a whole other layer of suffering.
So how do you stay positive in an industry that can feel unempathetic to your needs?
I don't know that I have the most insightful answer on that, because I think actually all of us are trying to figure that out collectively right now. The nice thing, the silver lining in what's going on right now, is the learning that you really are not alone. I think a lot of people, myself included, can definitely spiral into the thought that other people are making this work. They're making this career work, and they're making a living, and they're making good money, and I can't, and I'm not breaking in, and I'm clearly doing something wrong. And learning, no, it really is that hard. Like, there really is a very active and purposeful attempt to rob you of the fruits of your labor, is actually a little, well, it's galvanizing and it's reassuring. It's a little tragic, but I have much more of a sense right now of, okay, we really are all in this together than I think I ever have.
Yeah, I've been out on the picket lines as a SAG strike captain, and the biggest thing about this is that the community has never been larger or stronger than it is right at this moment.
Exactly.
How do you maintain your mental health as an artist in this industry when you are constantly forced to try something new and reevaluate and do a new thing and it didn't work and you've got a new thing to try? How do you keep your mindset from allowing you to make that downward spiral?
It took me a really long time to figure out. I've lived in LA for 9 years, and I've been in the industry longer than that, but it took me a long time to realize that the groundhog day that you experience living in LA, in part because of all the hustle that it requires to be here, but also in part because just simply there's no seasons. You know, it really is kind of the same every day. And sometimes we have really weird years where it rains for 7 months straight, like this past year, which is very unusual.
We
But
became
even
Portland for
that,
a minute.
even that was a groundhog's day. It's just a different one than we're used to. But I didn't realize for a while that that was hard on me mentally. And that did affect my writing, was it's just like, okay, we're up and we're doing the same thing over and over. So for me, the more I can take a little break, the better. So the more I can go home and see my friends back in Denver, and or even if it's just like a weekend. My first, when I first, very first started this story, I had, or The Witch, the very first story in the collection. I had written ideas, of course, and little pieces of the story as it came to me. But the first time I really sat down and was like, I'm going to write this, it was right after the 21 Sundance Festival, which was in January, and it was fully digital. So it was so much Zoom and so much work and so much screens. And I booked a hotel room in San Diego for a few days, and it overlooked the ocean. It had a balcony, and I just sat on the balcony and wrote. And that was just breaking the monotony was so essential for getting those ideas flowing.
And it seems like that lends itself to a better enjoyment of the process a little bit.
It was rejuvenating because, I mean, why wouldn't you want to write to the sound of the ocean? And I would get up in the morning and go sit outside on the deck. And I had this big, beautiful Penny Lane looking coat from Almost Famous, right? And because it was early February, so it was cold in the mornings, but I'd go sit on the balcony, wrap myself in that, and I see all the surfers arriving in the morning, like real early, getting those early waves. I just felt like, why wouldn't you want to sit and write there? It was really beautiful. Yeah, it was. And it reminds you too that like LA is a lot, the industry is a lot of pressure and a lot of work. And breaking that up does remind you that there is a whole big wide world outside of it, outside of that hustle, and that it's going to be okay if you take your foot off the gas for a minute.
So tell us a bit more about what's coming up for you, where and how we can see and hear the work that you're doing.
Well, the big push for us right now is getting the rest of these podcasts out. So like I said, episode 3 just dropped this morning. So that's The Acrobat, Running Away with a Traveling Circus. May or may not be somewhat inspired by me running away to stage manage a vaudeville show in my early 20s.
Oh my gosh, we could have had a whole interview about that, just that.
Yeah, but it was as fun as it sounds. It was great. So that's very exciting that we've got a new one out. And that one is very complex musically. So I'm very proud of my husband, Robin, for that one. And we've got 4 more coming as well. So it's 7 total. So those will be out between now and Halloween. And I'm just, yeah, going to be trying to get my book out there as much as possible, especially leading up to Halloween, getting some readings on the books and just seeing where I can take this.
Well, I think it's going to go far because I got to tell you, within all of this production talk, I got to say, you're a really great writer and a really great narrator. So
thank you so much.
Best of luck to you in this. Again, the book is called The Witch and Other Tales of the American Gothic. And not only is it a book, it is also a podcast that you can find on your podcast app. Jessica, do you have a minute to stick around and answer some stupid fucking questions for smart fucking people?
Let's do it. Sounds great.
Great. All right. In just a minute, we will be back with Jessica Hobbs and stupid fucking questions with smart fucking people. And we are back with Jessica Hobbs with stupid fucking questions with smart fucking people. You ready, Jessica?
Let's do it.
All right. Which Muppet do you most identify with?
Ooh, I really want to say the old guys who heckle everybody in the theater, but I don't think I do. I think that's just who I want to identify with.
Sadler and Waldorf.
Sadler and Waldorf, yes. I can only think of them as the Marley Brothers from the Muppet Christmas Carol.
Oh, they're really great. What is your comfort TV show to fall asleep to?
Right now it's Schitt's Creek.
I would not be able to sleep. I would just watch that all night. Is there a podcast out there you think people should give a chance to?
Well, it's pretty popular, so most people have probably already given it a chance, especially if they're interested in this sort of topic, but I would say The Old Gods of Appalachia.
Such a gorgeous podcast. That is one of my favorites. Do you have any songs that help you get into the creative spirit?
Yes, I have dozens. Really depends on what I'm working on at the moment, whether it is contemporary music or orchestral music. I guess it really depends on the project. But yes, always music, always. I'm working on a script right now, or it's actually done. I'm working on the pitch for it right now, post-strike pitch for it, that is about witches. So it's very heavy on the Stevie Nicks and the Nathaniel Rateliff and the Florence and the Machine.
Oh, you're speaking my language right there. That's great. Captain Planet style. Are you earth, wind, fire, water, or heart?
Ooh, I would love to say fire, but I'm a Scorpio and man, that is a water sign. So water for sure.
What is your movie theater snack of choice?
I mean, it has to be popcorn. I never even want popcorn until I walk in and I smell it and I just have to have it.
There's nothing wrong with a classic, right?
Yeah.
What's your big, I'm so happy you're a screenwriter. I can ask this question. What's your biggest screenwriting pet peeve, either in when you're writing it or when you're reading someone else's?
People say look way too much when they're leveling with each other.
And
Look.
so you're
They're
not
talking
talking
about blah,
we
blah.
you're not saying we see in the descriptives. You're talking literally a character going, look.
Literally that, yes. They're always in a conversation, and when you want to bring it home and have a character get the last word, they always say look. Nobody says, I never say look. I never say that. I use it all the time.
I am going to go through my new script and make sure I don't have any of that in there. What's your dream filming location?
New Orleans. I just want any excuse to go create art there. Absolutely.
Anything specific you would set there?
I mean, like, my dream would be to work on this new Interview with the Vampire series. Like, wow, just stunningly beautiful. Love it.
Yeah, I can understand that. If you could have power lunch with one non-living historical person, who would it be?
Non-living. Yeah, probably someone from Laurel Canyon. That's my favorite part of LA for obvious reason. It's just like the creative energy in Laurel Canyon is amazing, and I still feel like they're hanging around here sometimes. You know, Jim Morrison and so many of them who aren't with us anymore. So many of them still are. But yeah, I think I want to go to party at Frank Zappa's house. That's what I want.
That is such a great answer. That is such a cool. That's too cool for that question. Let me tell you that. Speaking of too cool questions, final question for you. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
I guess it has to be.
There wouldn't be a big hubbub about it if it had to be. So is there
Yes.
what's your reasoning for it is?
Well, I mean, it's bread and it's filling. Then that's a sandwich.
Simple as that. So a jelly donut
Yeah.
is a sandwich as well.
And condiments. So, you know, bread filling, which is usually a protein, but not always for our vegetarian and vegan friends, but bread, protein, and condiments is a sandwich.
And it's okay with you that it's just one piece of bread and it doesn't have to be two pieces of bread?
Well, depending on the hot dog, the bun often splits and becomes two pieces of bread. So.
That is such a Scorpio answer.
Oh,
Well, thank you, Jessica. I appreciate you answering these dumb questions really, really, really smartly.
well, thank you very much. What a great idea and a great way to end an interview. I love it.
If you'd like to support the show, click that follow button, share us with your friends, and give us a shout out on Instagram and Twitter at MYS Podcast. If you'd like to follow me, I'm on Instagram at Kyle F. Andrews. For those listeners who'd like to go the extra mile and help me make this shit, we also have a no pressure Patreon over at patreon.com/MYS Podcast. You can find these links and more in our show notes. I'm your host, Kyle F. Andrews. My consulting producer is Emily Castro. Our theme song is Keep On Dancing by Monday Hope. Until next time, keep making that shit.